Coming up on Fronteras, in what would be a historic move, Mexico may open up its energy industry to private, domestic, and foreign investors.
Any economic benefit that Mexico sees, Texas is going to see, especially when it comes to oil and gas.
How the state's preparing to get ahead of a possible overhaul of Mexico's energy industry. And the once biologically rich Colorado River Delta in the Southwest has shrunk dramatically as water upstream's been diverted.
We haven't had a river for decades, so you can imagine we are learning a lot about the river, how it behaves, where it moves, how the ecosystem responds.
U.S. and Mexico authorities released water into the Delta this spring to try to jumpstart habitat restoration. We'll see how that experiment's going. First, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Mexico may be opening up its energy industry, and Texas stands to benefit. Mexico's state monopoly Pemex has been in full control of the country's oil, but if the energy overhaul goes into effect, Mexico for the first time in decades will allow foreign investment in that country's energy sector. Texas Democratic Representative Terry Canales of Edinburgh is one of the state leaders trying to get ahead of this economic boom. He starts with how Texas stands to benefit.
Well, I mean, it's unquestionable that the only thing that separates Mexico and Texas is the Rio Grande. And any economic benefit that Mexico sees, Texas is going to see, especially when it comes to oil and gas. Since Texas is the oil and gas industry leader in production, especially in the shales, we're the experts. People may say that the Marcellus Shale and different shales, there's expertise, but Texas truly is the industry leader in the shale industry and shale production. And so if they start opening these fields up, they're going to need Texas expertise, they're going to need Texas companies, and they're going to need their knowledge and know-how. And so that directly translates into dollars coming back to Texas and to the United States.
So you're saying they would need Texas expertise. Do they have the infrastructure to take advantage of their energy resources without foreign involvement?
I do not believe that Mexico at this point has the know-how to actually efficiently extract the shale fuels.
Have you heard from Mexican leaders? Are they interested in working with Texas companies?
Well, I have not heard from them at this point. We're actually trying to schedule a joint committee hearing here in South Texas, preferably in Edinburgh, but if not there, then at the Capitol, where we bring industry leaders, stakeholders, the bureaucrats that are actually pushing for this in Mexico, and representatives from Pemex and industry leaders here in Texas to actually discuss what the options are. I think that Texas needs to be prepared for this, because if it actually transpires, which it looks as if it's going to, there's no better solution or cure for not getting the best out of everything than being prepared.
Do we know how much we could stand to benefit dollars-wise? Is that a known factor yet?
It's not a known factor, but there are questions as to how it's going to transpire. I don't think that they're going to turn over leases. I think that the fuel will actually still be property of Mexico, but there will probably be long-term service contracts is my understanding. But that's some of the things that the committee hearings that I'm requesting seek to vet out, is so that we can understand what Texas companies' role will be, what roles exist there, and how we can actually capitalize as a state on what's going to transpire. My understanding is that the reserves in the northern states of Mexico make the Eagle Ford Shale look tiny.
And speaking of Eagle Ford, we know that that's been an economic boost to some communities, created jobs. But there, as you know, have been some environmental concerns, especially when it comes to fracking. Are there any concerns about how expanded oil and gas operations might impact Mexico in that regard?
There's no question. Fracking has a lot of concerns for a lot of people and poses a lot of risks. One of the things that is precious to us in Texas is water. Without water, there's no life. And that's why the speaker and I actually sit on the special committee to study desalination is actually taking place. One of the hearings taking place this Monday that I will be a part of. But getting back to water, our water tables and our natural water tables lie within the some of the zones of the areas where you frack. And so you've got to be extremely cautious and prudent on how you harvest the minerals. We need to do so responsibly, whether it's in Texas or whether it's in Mexico. And definitely there are risks involved. But as I said earlier, Texas is the industry leader and the gold standard for drilling. And so they would be the best equipped to handle and be the most environmentally friendly production people.
Another risk that comes to mind is drug cartels. Could the violence in Mexico deter foreign investors?
Sure, absolutely. You know, there's been numbers of kidnappings of American citizens. We've seen or jailings of American citizens. And so the violence is a very real aspect. We need to address that in these hearings. We need the Mexican government, and not only the Mexican government, but the American government, to engage in a serious dialogue as to what we're going to do to curb the violence. I remember a time when I used to freely travel back and forth with my family to Mexico, and we would enjoy dinner, and that is no longer the case. We do not travel to Mexico because of the risks. And so I've never seen any spillover violence here in the Rio Grande Valley, but I can tell you the violence is very real over there. I have a family that actually works in the Border Patrol, and they say they hear, you know, bombs, grenades, machine guns on a daily basis. And so that being a very real factor, it is something that needs to be considered in whatever business model and whoever is actually going to invest in Mexico.
You mentioned hearings. What are some of the things the state could do to create more of an energy partnership between the two countries?
Well, the state, there's a lot. I mean, definitely there's legislation, there's policy decisions, there's breaks, there's incentives that they can give oil and gas companies. That is what we seek to figure out. What can we do? And those are the questions we want to answer with the hearings. What is the state of Texas able to do into creating an international – Texas is already an international partner with Mexico. Let there be no mistake. We are their neighbor and their largest trade friend, and so – this would be an expansion of that partnership. We have a long history of cooperating with Mexico, of doing business with Mexico, and we've actually got sister cities in Mexico that we call. And so what we're trying to do here through the legislature and through the powers that be and those that know how and those people in the know is determine exactly what can we do to effectively and efficiently create an expanded partnership.
That was Representative Terry Canales speaking about Mexico's proposed energy overhaul. San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro's nomination process to join the Obama administration is well underway. Castro is President Obama's pick to lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development. From San Antonio, Ryan Lloyd reports on how Castro progressed to the national level.
In downtown San Antonio, traffic scoots steadily along the streets near City Hall, where Julian Castro often walks to city council meetings. The city's congenial, good-looking mayor has been in office for 5 years, a good length of time because of a change in term limits. So he's been able to take on what he calls the big projects.
Of improving educational achievement, of improving health and fitness in our community, of enhancing our economic development to get 21st century jobs here, and of ensuring that our urban core is revitalized.
One of Castro's ambitious goals was to build 7,500 affordable housing units in and around downtown by 2020. More than a third are under construction or are finished. And in announcing his nomination, President Obama cited his work revitalizing San Antonio, which is now the nation's seventh largest city.
This year, my administration named the east side of San Antonio a promise zone, a place where citizens and the federal government are working together to remake the community family by family and block by block.
Castro's personal background is also appealing. He is the grandson of a Mexican immigrant, and his mother Rosario, a homemaker and political activist, raised Julian and his twin brother Congressman Joaquin Castro and put them and then herself through school. Both her boys graduated from Harvard Law School.
So yesterday you guys worked a lot to kind of discover who am I in my culture. What kind of story do I want to tell to bring to light my culture?
At Thomas Jefferson High School, history classes like Mrs. Heller's today teach the Castro legacy. Carita Thomas is Julian Castro's former chemistry teacher and says the mayor was a quiet student and focused on academics.
And I can say that the times that I asked him a question, he was very well equipped to answer it. You know, and as far as labs and things were concerned, he was always a planner, so he was a leader in the laboratory. I was hoping he would go into science.
But Castro's biggest asset may be his political connections. He has a big backer in Henry Cisneros, a former mayor of San Antonio, who also went on to serve as HUD secretary under President Clinton. Cisneros grew up with Castro's mom, who he calls Rosie.
I remember Rosie from kindergarten. She worked in the city government during the years that I was mayor. And then both Julian and Joaquin were one class behind my daughter at Stanford. There's a lot of family interconnections over a lot of years.
The former HUD secretary says he is now prepping the potential next HUD secretary.
On many of the things that are most important to HUD and therefore to a HUD secretary, San Antonio has excelled. So one of the most important obligations of the HUD secretary is to focus on homelessness. Those Americans who are completely unhoused have to be one of our highest priorities.
Political science professor Walt Wilson at the University of Texas at San Antonio says there is another reason Obama might want Castro in Washington.
To be representative of the country, the Obama administration needs some top Hispanics or Latinos in some of those cabinet posts. And so Julian Castro is ready-made to fit that bill.
Motion carries. Let's go to item number 24.
Back at City Hall, Councilman Ray Saldana talks sentimentally about the prospect of Castro leaving.
Losing him at that seat will be losing somebody who thinks about this city in terms of the next 20 years and the next, you know, generation.
While the confirmation process in Washington, D.C. is only just beginning, the City Council in San Antonio is already thinking of how to replace Julian Castro and maintain momentum for the city's rise. Reporting for Fronteras, I'm Ryan Lloyd in San Antonio.
There's more Fronteras coming up, a two-part series about how two countries are working together to try to bring the Colorado River Delta back from the dead. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. The Colorado River Delta was once among the largest and most ecologically rich wetlands in North America. It wasn't until every single drop of Colorado River water was assigned to a city or farm in the western U.S. or in Mexico. But this past spring, the Delta experienced its first flood in decades, a managed flood. Authorities released water from a dam on the U.S.-Mexico border over a period of 2 months to mimic the spring floods that used to flow into the Delta annually. Jamilet Carrillo, one of the environmentalists involved in the project, told Fronteras it was the first time both countries worked together to actually do something for the environment, for an ecosystem that was really damaged. The goal is to restore a small part of the decimated Delta ecosystem. KPBS reporter Jill Replogle recently visited the area. She brings back this first of a two-part story about this historic experiment.
The temperature had finally dropped below 100 degrees as Juan Butron and Alejandra Calvo set out toward the bank of the Colorado River, about 10 miles south of the Mexican border town of Algodones. They're recording data from one of the transects scientists have set up to measure the effects of the pulse flow, as it's called, the rush of water sent down the river valley over a two-month period this spring. At the height of that pulse flow, Calvo tells me, water in this spot would have come up to my waist. Now it's just dry sand.
So this is our seed traps.
The trap is a 2 foot by 2 foot piece of plywood nailed onto two skinny legs. It's covered in a sticky substance that traps flying seeds when they land on it, along with a few unfortunate insects.
So we look for the seeds of cottonwoods and willows. But if you see all these white stuff, all of this is tamarisk.
Tamarisk, or salt cedar, as it's also known, is a highly invasive species that has taken over large sections of the Colorado River Delta. It thrives where native vegetation, like cottonwood and willow, has died off because of poor soil and no water.
So,
well, so you're going to count all of these seeds on here?
Yeah, but we do this because a lot of them, right? So we do a scale.
Calvo uses sticks to divide the seed trap into 16 squares. Then, kind of like hopscotch, Butrón tosses three twigs onto the table. Then he and Calvo count the seeds in the squares where the twigs land.
258.
At this and other sites along the river, scientists are looking at how well native vegetation is responding to the one-time rush of spring water. Under normal conditions, it would nourish seedlings and replenish the groundwater that mature trees depend on in this desert ecosystem. They're also studying whether birds and other wildlife that used to flourish here are coming back. All this data from dozens of sites around the Colorado River Delta will help environmentalists and policymakers answer a question. How well is this massive restoration experiment working? Jamilet Carrillo is an expert on water issues in the Delta.
We haven't had a river for decades, so you can imagine we are learning a lot about the river, how it behaves, where it moves, how the ecosystem responds.
The project already achieved one unexpected success. Last month, the Colorado River reached the Gulf of California, 100 miles downstream, for the first time in 16 years.
It's something that we wanted, but we knew that maybe the flows are not going to be enough to reconnect the river with the sea. So that was a major celebration for everybody working on this.
A couple decades ago, this seemed like a distant dream. Water, as Californians well know, is ever contentious in our part of the country. Then add to that an international boundary. A lot of planning and years of political wrangling preceded this year's experiment on the Colorado. What helped make it happen was a strange twist of environmental fate, Carrillo says.
Ironically, thanks to an earthquake that happened in 2010 in Mexicali.
That earthquake damaged irrigation canals in one of Mexico's most important farming areas, and they needed help repairing them. Plus, Mexico needed a place to store its share of Colorado River water while those canals were replaced. So the U.S. paid for some of the repairs, and in exchange, water stored at Lake Mead in Arizona flowed into the Delta. Back at the riverbank, Juan Butrón scrapes the sticky goo off the plywood and applies a new coat to trap more seeds. Scientists will present an initial report on the progress of restoration in August, though they say it'll take years to see real change. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
The once biologically rich Colorado River Delta has shrunk by an estimated 90% since those dams and diversions siphoned off most of the water upstream. Now, Joe Replogle tells us it's largely up to conservation organizations and the public to continue the work.
In the middle of a scorching hot day in the Mexicali Valley, several women splash down a recently dredged channel. They're wearing long-sleeved hoodies and pants to protect themselves from the sun, and they're carrying pallets full of slender, foot-high willow trees. Guadalupe Fonseca from the Sonoran Institute, an environmental organization based in Tucson, Arizona, digs holes for the young trees in the riverbank with his squeaky shovel. His team of 10 will plant more than 1,000 trees here today. Now that the experimental flood has ended, Fonseca explains, this restoration site is being fed with water from irrigation canals. Under the binational deal that made the Delta Restoration Project possible, Mexican and American conservation groups agreed to buy or lease water rights from farmers in the Delta. They'll use that water to keep a constant base flow running to key restoration sites over the next 4 years. And they're hoping the public will help pay for that water. The groups have enlisted Robert Redford and Will Farrell to promote a fundraising campaign with a twist of irony.
By adding just a small amount of water to the river's flow, we can help bring life back to the wetlands and marshes in the Delta.
And I say, do we really need more river? I mean, hell, we got plenty of ocean. Let's move it. Let's reconnect these things the old-fashioned way, the American way. The way to fix this thing is to send money. So myself,
the Environmental Defense Fund, one of the American NGOs behind the campaign, says it's more than three quarters of the way toward its goal of raising $10 million. Non-governmental organizations play a huge role in the restoration effort. They've been pushing Mexican and U.S. authorities to release water into the Colorado River Delta for more than two decades.
We want to give a lot of credit to the NGOs They have been raising these issues to us for many, many years.
Sally Spiener is Foreign Affairs Officer for the International Boundary and Water Commission. That's the joint U.S.-Mexican agency that negotiates management of the Colorado River.
It is safe to say, I think, that we would not have had this type of agreement without their support and active involvement.
A dense thicket of trees mellows the harsh desert sun and lowers the temperature dramatically. Juliana Dimas from the Mexican conservation group ProNatura gives me a tour of a four-year-old restoration site the group helps manage in the Colorado River Delta. She points out 30-foot-tall cottonwood trees planted several years ago. Birds are among the best indicators of ecosystem health, Dimas explains. We hear a lot of them here. Conservationists hope that at least some of the desiccated wetland habitat will spring back on its own and eventually be able to fend for itself. But humans have altered the landscape here so much that nature needs a hand.
You know, people are going to have to be active in managing these natural habitats.
Carl Flessa heads the team of scientists in the U.S. and Mexico studying the effects of the Delta Restoration Experiment. With the prospects of an even drier climate in the future, conservationists are carefully tending the sites where they think restoration has the most chance for success. That's where the data Flessa's team is collecting comes in.
Let's face it, you know, we all have to use water efficiently. It has to be done on the farms, it has to be done in the cities, and it has to be done in restoration efforts. And, you know, this is a big opportunity to learn how to do that best for restoration.
In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past Fronteras shows online at tpr.org under the Programs tab. If you want to share these stories with your friends on social media, there are one-click buttons to Facebook and Twitter. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.